Good afternoon. I'm afraid that my presentation will be a little apart from the mainstream of this conference, because let me begin with some theoretical observations on the concept of porosity. Given the etymology of the word porosity, and poros in Greek, in ancient Greek, means something like a gap, a vacuum, hole, or something like that. I think that we can speak of three levels of porosity in contemporary societies when migrations are involved. The first level is the level of what I would call reciprocity, porosity in the sense of osmosis or something like that. And it means an exchange, two-way exchange, reciprocal exchange of goods, commodities, informations, values, money, and so on. Think the web, and you can imagine the web like a sort of global, huge vacuum into which information and goods and commodities can be exchanged in a reciprocal way. Of course, naturally, there are many restraints and blocking in this realm. For example, when some states put taxation on some commodities, or when some states block the web for political or any reason. But in this sphere, in this realm, material and immaterial goods can be exchanged. The second level is quite different, because it involves the circulation of the blocking of human beings. In this sense, we can speak of two ways reciprocity, but not reciprocal one. For example, tourists can flow from northern or rich or western states to poor or southern or eastern states without no difficulties, but at the same time, migrants can flow or can try to flow from southern or eastern or poor states to our countries with many difficulties. This is a realm of visas, of frontiers, of borders, armed watchmen, and so on. Imagine a great divide, the line, going west to eastward, beginning at the border between the United States of America and Mexico, and follow this line eastward, passing through the southwestern states of the United States, and going eastward, and jumping on the Atlantic Ocean, and restarting in the southern shores of the Mediterranean Sea, and going eastward, passing through Palestine and Syria and Lebanon and Iran, and arriving to Afghanistan. This great, great divide, that line, separates two worlds. And given this situation, we can say that we have two kinds of porosity, one of tourists and so on, and the other more and more complicated. So in this sense, we have two movements, two flows, but in no way a reciprocal flow of human beings. But if we speak of the third level usually is not involved when we are concerned with migrations. And the third level is what I would call the level of humanitarian bombing, of wars, of contemporary wars. And this too is a kind of porosity. No, I don't want to make a pun, but imagine with bombing, of course, is opening holes on the ground, but I'm not speaking of porosity in this sense. I'm thinking of another kind of relation between the two worlds, because except for the United States and Mexico, the great divide, the great line, west to eastward, in fact defined define the relation, the armed relation, violent, warlike relation between two worlds. And I propose to take into account in every study of contemporary migrations also this third level, because it's impossible to speak of migrations, I mean relation between human beings in the world, without studying this kind of relation. Because I'm speaking of contemporary armed conflicts when the two worlds are involved. For example, now in the so-called Arabian or Islamic uprising or spring, for example, in Libya. Now, perhaps you think that I'm speaking of this third kind of porosity because our country, because the southern countries of European Union are involved, but in fact all Europe is involved in this kind of conflict, even if only 25 states of NATO and Europe are involved. But in fact, all Europe is involved in this kind of third level of porosity. I mean, the armed, I would call it armored porosity and bombing porosity. So, this third level, it's war. That's a strange kind of war. In order to understand what kind of war, let me recall an example concerning the United States of America. In this history of the United States of America, the American territory was attacked only four times in the history. The first time was the English Army in 1814, when the English Army destroyed and put on fire Washington D.C. The second time was when an armed party guided by Pancho Villa, well-known Mexican leader, invaded New Mexico and attacked the city of Columbus, New Mexico. And in retaliation for this attack, the English army, guided by General Pershing, and George Patton, who became a well-known general in the Second World War, tried to track Pancho Villa until the heartland of Mexico. The third time, of course, was Pearl Harbor, and everyone knows the story of Pearl Harbor. The fourth time was September 11, 2001. In all the history of the United States of America, only four times American territory was attacked by outside armies or outside war parties. But the contrary is more complicated, because starting with the end of the communism in 89, our world, the world of tourists, the world of exchange of all the commodities and goods, so on, is involved in a continuous war for every reason, humanitarian, democratic, or so on, is involved in a war on the other part of the world. So this kind of porosity is very hierarchical, there's not reciprocity, but it changed the nature of the relation between the other kind of porosity, I mean the goods and human beings. And I think that we can detect some relationship between the three levels of relations. For example, the real of the global porosity, according to general opinion, like President Obama recalled to us in his speech with Cameron in London a week ago, the level of exchange of information and so on affected the uprising of democracy in Eastern, in Maghreb, Marrakesh, and other countries. Because we know that in Egypt, for example, people using the web and so on could spread democratic relations and build another kind of democracy. Struggling, fighting against dictatorship in a number of countries. The second level is involved because with the level of arms and fight, because flows of population are really affected by war. For example, after the beginning of civil war in Libya, about 1 million people, 1 million migrants from Central Africa and Asia and Southern Asia and so on, were forced to change and to go to Tunisia in order to save their lives. You remember perhaps what which turmoil was generated in my country, in Italy, when 25,000 migrants began to go to Lampedusa and the southern shores of Italy. Only 25,000. In fact, Tunisia was able to accept about 1 million people from Libya. You can understand how, in this situation, the perspective change according the point of view. For us, for Europeans, 25,000 people are a menace, are a danger of our situation. But Tunisia was able to accept and nourish 1 million people. So, in this sense, all three levels, the great porosity, global porosity, two-way porosity, and the third level of porosity of war, are have strong relationship. And according to me, now it's impossible to study not only in the southern Europe, but all over the world. It's impossible to study migrations and movements of population without taking into account the relation between web circulation of people and war. My friend Yussi this morning talked about Gibraltar and this famous statement that society is not a totality, not the thing, the great thing. And I agree with him. I think the society has a sort of many webs, many nets, many with relation, changing relation in every time. But in this image of the global society, war has a strong and very important role. So let me say something about the contemporary conception of war. Over the recent years, several sociologists and scholars of international relations seem to share a common perspective on contemporary wars, especially, I'm speaking in fact of the third level, especially when Western powers are involved. War no more represents a disruption of everyday life, marked by rituals of discontinuity. And according to traditional idea, conception of war was a sort of rupture, break of everyday life. You may imagine people going to the railway station and the troopers in the wagon, in the train, living to the front, to the frontier, to the border, and so on. Now we live in Europe, we live in Pacific, very peaceful societies, and even our troopers are fighting this morning. For example, Italian troopers are fighting in Lebanon, fighting or participating to armed peacemaking actions in Syria, Lebanon, in Libya, Lebanon, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on. But nobody is concerned with that. Our everyday life continues more and more peaceful, and it is a strange kind of war. As Michel Foucault pointed out in his studies on biopolitics and governmentality, the famous sentence in this frame by Clausewitz, war is a continuation of politics by other means, can be easily reversed. Politics is a continuation of war by other means. In other words, war and peace, or arms and politics, can be considered as facets of a continuous reality, without no disruption, no solution of continuity. This is altogether clear in the Libya war. The resolution 1973 of the United Nations of March 2011 allowed to the NATO organization to establish a no-fly zone in Libya and the use of military force in order to protect the civilian in Benghazi from the attack of Gaddafi's armored army. But from March until now, the strategic goals of NATO were part of the NATO, I mean French, Britons, and minor powers like Italy, shifted from the protection of civilians to the building of another nation, without any particular reaction by international community. The goals of this military action shift, it began as an humanitarian intervention in order to protect civilians. Now it's officially considered rebuilding of the Libyan nation. Now the declared goal of NATO is to kill or at least to chase Gaddafi from power. But it doesn't mean that European at war with Libya, at least officially, or with Gaddafi. Bombing Tripoli, protecting Benghazi, and changing the rulers of Libya appear to depend on the same armed governmentality. In this sense, I propose to speak of civilization of war. By this expression, I don't mean that war is becoming more human or moral according to the commonsensical perspective dominating Western ideology. By no means contemporary wars show a concern for civilians involved or a significant diminution of civilian casualties. The figure of 100,000 to 1 million dead in Iraq war from 2003 until today demonstrated, according to me, to what extent Western powers are concerned with the fate of civilians. By civilization, I'm rather willing to suggest that war becomes more and more an option, a mere option, suitable for Western powers without any relevant relation to the classical conception of war. Classical idea of war is based on on interruption of everyday life. Usually war, but now usually war is not, it never declared. We don't know any declaration of war. Ambassadors can be expelled or not. I remember the strange case in 1991 when the Western powers, when NATO began to bomb Serbia, Belgrade, and so on. The case of a Serbian ambassador speaking in Western television during the bombing of Serbia and defending the position of Serbia. It was quite strange. Imagine the war, the last war in the 19th century or also in the 20th century, for example, Nez ambassador in London or English ambassador in Berlin speaking for their country. This is quite strange. Casualties are not counted or denied because this kind of war is not an official war. In a sense, we don't have casualties. There is a sort of a transformation of casualties not even in numbers, in the gray zone. In the gray zone, and sometimes people can speak of death and so on, but states are not concerned with the official figures of death. By the way, perhaps someone of us remember famous Baudrillard sentence according to which war never occurred in Kuwait in 91, no? When the alliance, the international alliance, began to bomb Baghdad in order to expel Iraqi army from Kuwait. Baudrillard, thinking to TV sets and so on, said that it was a war, it was only a TV war. Even in his paradoxical style, the French philosopher showed to endorse the official version of the United Nations, according to which war in Kuwait was a kind of international law enforcement without any effect on civilians. In fact, a lot of Iraqi people were dead on this occasion, but according to Baudrillard, the war never occurred. This means only the Western population can be at war with other human beings who in fact die and suffer without noticing it. Let me see if I have the time to recall a short episode. I remember in 1991, when the war began in Iraq, a lot of people in the town where I was living in this time, in Milan, in northern Italy, when they read that war was beginning, went to the supermarkets and so on in order to collect pasta and pomodori and food, because they thought that the war would be implied bombing from the other world and so on, but never occurred. When the other war began in 2003 and so on, nobody went to the supermarkets in order to buy food and so on. Of course, the idea of civilization of armed conflicts can be argued by other important features. For example, the role of a non-governmental organization. Usually, NGOs follow the armies, like in the Balkans and in other states, offering what? Support, civilian support, and so on, following the armies. Or think to the idea, very contemporary idea of nation building. Nation building, it means to reconstruct civil ministry, civil administration, and so on. Or, not to speak of another very interesting feature of contemporary wars, and it means the role of contractors, of so-called corporate warriors in these wars. According recent statistics, now, for example, the United States of America, only the United States of America, of about 200,000 soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the number of civil contracts is about 300,000. And with contractors, we mean not only people fighting or supporting fight on the battleground, but also people working in NGOs and so on. In this sense, the war is becoming more and more a business in which use of arms and bombs and civil actions are so mixed that it's quite impossible to separate military action from civil action. In sum, civilized war is a sort of global police enforcement where the police leaders change according to the circumstances of the political situation. They can be agents of the United Nations, like in 1991, coalition of NATO, North Atlantic Alliance, in 1999, or officially in Libya. Single state acting on behalf of NATO, now in Libya, or single state is lacking any particular legitimation, like United States and UK in 2003. A very important feature of the contemporary wars, of course, in this gloomy landscape, is the issue of migration. I'll try to explain now how contemporary wars are changing the nature of migrations and, moreover, of response of our states, of our countries to migration. Let me recall that nowadays the classical distinction between economic migrants, people looking for better condition of life, and political refugees, people escaping from war, violence, or oppression, cannot be maintained. For example, the hundreds of thousands of immigrants to Libya coming from Asia or Central Africa are at the same time mixing the definition, political migrants and economic refugees. Given the mixed status of migration and the normality of contemporary wars in the sense of civilized war that I tried to explain, the normal exchange between northern and southern countries doesn't follow the ordinary channels. These exchanges are not more made of human beings coming from underdeveloped countries and from one part, and money and civil technology going to the poor countries. Today, the exchange is made of bombs, in a concrete sense, or other weapons versus human beings. And not only saying that our bombs are causing the flight of countless people. In fact, they are. I'm also saying that the managing of people and managing weapons belong to the same international plane. For example, our interior minister, Maroni, you know, in Italy, Italian politics are quite strange, I think, for foreigners. And in this moment, the Italian government is participating to the war in Libya, but one of the parties that belong to the government, to the actual government, is against the war. In other words, Italian government is making the war, but at the same time, one of the main parties, I mean the League, Northern League, is against war. And the explanation of this opposition to war is our wars, these wars in Libya, are causing the arrival of many, many millions of migrants. Usually when Italian politicians are defending the decision to make war to another country, for example in 1999 or now, the explanation, the common explanation is we are making war in order to avoid the arrival of many millions of migrants. And I don't think that relation would be, it's very mechanical, it's quite stupid, no, to explain, to interpret the relation between war and migration in this mechanical sense. I'm saying only that in order to understand the interplay between the three levels, communication and exchange of goods, circulation of people and circulation of bonds, you have to take in account the complicated relation between among them. Let me remember, so I'm coming to the core of my presentation, that when the provisional government of Benghazi tried to gain the support of European powers, it was eager immediately to confirm the previous treaties on oil and on the prevention of the so-called illegal migrations. Southern Europe governments, Italian, French, Spanish, and Greek, signed some treaties with Tunisia, Morocco, Egypt, and Libya. And I would define this kind of treaties oil for people, or people for food, or people for money. In other words, our governments give money to this government, especially when governments were made of dictators and so on, in order to block the migrants in the desert. And it's quite strange, and it's not strange, it's quite significant that revolutionary forces in Benghazi, or at least their leaders, were eager to confirm these treaties. In other sense, the conflict between dictatorship and democracy in this part of the world is like doesn't imply any liberation, any circulation, any special porosity of men. I think that's quite interesting because it allowed us to imagine another world, perhaps in the next future, into which democracies, I mean, legitimated governments in Libya, Egypt, and so on, will pursue the same politics on migrants. These observations are not meant to be critical, I would be clear on that, towards the democratic movement in Tunisia or towards the revolutionary force in Benghazi. I would like only to point out that revolutionary forces have to pay the price to the Western powers in exchange for their military support. Of course, political realism is not ignored by Libyan Shabab, or at least by their leaders. We could say with the time that this is only the war, stupid. I think that the same observation, coming to the end of my presentation, can be useful to place in a realistic side perspective contemporary struggles for democracy in Maghreb, Mashrek, or Middle East countries. Revolution, in the sense, are even when, or especially when, other superposed powers are involved, like international coalition and so on, revolution are seldom innocent in the long run. They elicit enthusiasm and moral support when we see unarmed people, civilians, fighting against armored cars and police in the streets of Cairo, Benghazi, or Syria. And I think that global political opinion is right in doing so and in supporting this uprising against dictatorship. But it costs a lot in terms of porosity and circulation of human beings in a globalized world. Yes, I think also that the Western army support has a very high price for people living in those countries. The pursuit of democracy can be not for the people, for fighters in the streets of this state, but for us. For us, I mean, for people living in the rich countries, in what I would call the tourist countries. The pursuit of democracy can be an alibi to maintain in their place, I mean in a subordinate place, these new democracies and their population. This is rather clear in Tunisia and in Egypt, where the national armies are warranting the transition from dictatorship to democracy with the blessing of Western powers, and at the same time they are warranting the blocking of migrants from those countries to our world. So if we look there, these are my final consideration. If they look to contemporary migration, to the exchange of population between Northern Europe and the Southern states in the context of the three levels, communication, migrations, and war, perhaps we have a gloomy picture, because we see that in this situation, this conflict between democracy and dictatorship, and this attempt to spread democracy all over the world, there are always victims. I mean victims in the sense of people to whom any freedom of movement is denied. Perhaps in the ancient sense of freedom, remember that in ancient Greece, free people were only those who were eager to risk their life against dictatorship and power. But those people who didn't accept the risk of their life, to these people, any freedom or identity of citizenship was denied. In fact, the reality is quite different, because we know that people coming from the south to the north and trying to trespass the Mediterranean Sea, the channel of Sicily and so on, are risking their life. But perhaps in our despising attitude toward them, at the beginning of the 20th century, the same attitude of despise and contempt toward people who doesn't takes the arms in order to fight for their freedom. And I think that in this sense, the very victims, not the only victims, but the very victims of this new situation in the context of international relation between North and South, and so on, democracy and dictatorship, are migrants, like in the past, and I'm afraid like in the next future. Thank you.